Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, one and all. We are back with Web Sleuth Radio, and tonight we are welcoming back the filmmakers behind the hit series on A&E called The Killing Season. We're going to discuss the episodes that we saw on Saturday. That was Episode 5, Different Season, and Episode 6, A Killer on the Road. Joining us tonight will be the Chief of Detectives at the Charleston Police Department in West Virginia, Steve Cooper. Also on the show, Prosecutor Marie Claire Akers from the Charleston District Attorney's Office. They'll be talking about several different things, but also discussing the suspected and now dead serial killer, Neil Falls. This kind of suspected serial killer is a dead one. Falls was killed by an escort. And later in the show, we're going to talk to Tom Hargrove from the Murder Accountability Project. I love this guy. Their organization actually sues law enforcement agencies to get them to keep track of the murders in their cities. And finally, we're going to welcome Heather Sutphin from the podcast Sword and Scale, and she also has a lot to offer about Neil Falls. Okay, Josh and Rachel, you warned us last week, Episode 5 and 6, totally kicked ass. Let's start with Episode 5, and I am the first one with a question, and it goes to Josh. Josh, you're the one that you tried to have a discussion with a machete-wielding crazy person in an area covered in vegetation and probably more dead bodies all over the place. Josh Zeman, what were you thinking?
We were just trying to find the spot where Alyssa Gage's mom was found. You know, she wanted to go to the spot, and it was very interesting. Just, that's never happened to me before, where you kind of meet a victim's family member who was so young at the time and kind of didn't know it. And it's just amazing to me how much she looks like her mother. It was weird. And, it's, like we said, Daytona's rough around the edges. You know, you go there on vacation, get locked up on, what is it, Rach? Go there on vacation?
Oh, yeah, go on vacation, stay, what is it?
Get locked up on violation. Yeah. Leave on probation, come back on violation or something like that.
Yeah.
My kind of place.
And
I'm sorry, Josh, go ahead. I should say it's just such a
wild. No. Some guy told.
So wild.
Well, thank you. But some guy told us today that he was probably protecting a meth lab.
Huh.
And we didn't know.
Oh, that makes sense. The guy with the machete, yeah. Well, understandably, that's his business, and, you know, doesn't want strangers coming in and upsetting the operation, of course. That really did scare me, though, and I can't imagine what the footage that was left on the floor, but you didn't seem scared at all, and I'm screaming at the TV, what the hell? Get the hell out of there. And you were trying to have a conversation with this man, and he was having no part of it. And it was so sad because that's where Alyssa's mother was found. The whole thing was just tragic.
Yeah.
And so then after that, if that wasn't enough, you had to go and hook up with some biker gangs. And talk about scary. And Rachel, you even said in the show that you were worried because they were actually doing their own recognizance, trying to find out who you were. Let's talk about that, and let's talk about the other victims and how all of that came together and how you survived.
Well, I just want to, just since you brought up the outlaws, going there, knocking on the door, and then leaving, not thinking we would hear from them, that they would call us, that we'd ever see them again. We just kind of regrouped at the gas station that was a few blocks away, and that Mustang came up. And literally, I saw them holding the phone to the window, checking us out. And the funny thing is, and you can't tell in the show, but that's actually a woman in that vehicle. And our security team who was with us is like, they send their women out to do their dirty work, essentially. And they were not surprised at all that they did that. You know, they said they're probably taking a picture. They're probably running the plates right now because they want to know who you are.
Wow.
Yeah, they want to make sure that we're not law enforcement. That was another interesting thing, which is, so when the guy's like, who's behind you? Apparently, we're told that when law enforcement come and does a raid, sometimes they're in, like, minivans, like straight-up, like, you know, soccer mom minivans. And so we were very worried because when they saw the minivans, we thought that they thought they were going to get raided. you know, and if there's a guy inside who, you know, for whatever reason isn't going out without a fight, then, you know, it turns into something nobody's prepared for. It's weird. And in film business, we call it all the time. It's like you feel like somehow you're impervious, you know, until you're not. And, you know, and but you know, look, you know, we were just trying to find out what the deal was with these women. And, you know, if anybody was going to know, they were going to know. That, by the way, happened right before the shootout in Texas. Was that right, Rach?
No, it happened after.
Huh, so we knew about the shootout in Texas.
Yeah,
and we
still
went. Tell us what shootout. Remind our audience.
Oh, wasn't there a shootout in Texas last year?
There was a shootout between, like, 9 different rival motorcycle gangs. I don't believe the Outlaws was one of those gangs. That didn't happen, but, like, 6 months beforehand. Rival gangs that were at the level of the Outlaws, probably some of the, quote-unquote, one percenters. Which are the people who murder and have prostitution rings and traffic drugs. So, you know,
alleged.
That had just happened. Allegedly.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the victims. Let's just give a quick roundup, perhaps, for those people that missed episode 5, different season. If you did miss these episodes, you can go to A&E, The Killing Season, and you can watch them right there. But Josh and Rachel, give us just a brief description of the women and what you found, what the episode included. What did you find out when you went down to Daytona?
Sure. Well, we went down to Daytona because of some web sleuths were saying how, you know, they felt that maybe it was connected to Atlantic City and Long Island. And, you know, again, the theory of the show is that we go kind of wherever the story takes us, and it's about kind of going down that rabbit hole. And it was very interesting because here was another 4 women in another kind of like tourist town, you know. And when you start to theorize who may be responsible, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, it's about seasonal people. You know, that was one of the big things about Lisk, is that the killer was probably seasonal because the women were killed in the summer. And so you wonder, well, you know, does somebody go, like that go down to like warmer climates in the winter?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was interesting. Of course, the fact that there were 4 women and then the fact that they were sex workers. But upon going down there, we kind of realized that these women were different. You know, they weren't, you know, like escorts. They were occasional, you know, sex workers, and
mm-hmm.
it was a different scenario, but yet I think indicative of the larger nightmare that we're talking about here. You know, one of the things that was so disturbing was looking at some of the press coverage, that Fox interview, they completely concentrated on, you know, spring break and not who these women were, you know. And unfortunately, like, that's something that happens a lot. There's a lot of fear-mongering with the press. It happened with the Lisk case. It didn't really happen as much, interestingly enough, as we found out with Atlantic City, because Atlantic City didn't want that getting out. They didn't even say serial killer. You know, why? Because you don't want, you know, to ruin tourism in Atlantic City. But they did in Daytona. But, of course, here they totally disregarded the victims. And, you know, that's what we, the press, do. We want to sell newspapers. We want to, you know, get viewers. And so we're not going to show you these women who you know, kind of are very rough around the edges, because you're going to immediately say, well, I'm never going to be like that, you know. But if I'm fear-mongering, I'm going to show you, you know, college co-eds, because, you know, chances are, you know, your teenage daughter is down in, you know, Daytona right now. So it's how, it, you know, like the idea of, like, if it bleeds, it leads. And that's something that we wanted, again, to show the public. This is how these serial murder cases are manipulated. These are how the press manipulates them for a better storyline, for more ratings. And unfortunately, that's one of the many reasons why these cases don't get solved. But I think that was very egregious. Like, I just, to me, I was just like, okay, if you, how can you not in all ethics show these women? And, you know, it was disturbing. But what's so great about the Daytona, what's so great, I don't mean to say that, but what's refreshing about the Daytona case was Mike Chitwood. He was
the
most transparent law enforcement.
Right.
I'm sorry?
Chief of police, right?
Yeah.
Chief of police?
Yeah, the Daytona chief of police. And comes from a long line of officers in Philadelphia, and was just really open and great, and just was really amazing. And, you know, he was very transparent, you know, to the point where he holds, like, these CompStat meetings where they go through, like, you know, all the week's crime in Daytona with, like, the general public. That's a man who has nothing to fear. You know, that's a man who's open, and it shows in his department. And now I think he is the sheriff of Volusia County. So he was my hero, that sheriff. He was just Mike Chitwood. He was so great.
And you're right about it being refreshing, because at the beginning of the episode 5, when you had Stacey Gage's daughter Alyssa. And she was saying that they wouldn't, that law enforcement wouldn't even let their family file a missing persons report. They had to file a stolen van report, and that made me furious. How dare they miss a human being's life like that? And I don't think now that would happen. I don't think that would happen. But back then, it was horrible. They said they made a big deal out of the fact that the press made a big deal out of the fact that they only filed the missing van report. But that's because the police wouldn't let them file in missing persons because, you know, their mother was a drug addict and, you know, suck it up, she'll be back. Awful.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. before we even went down there, of course, I did my research. I'm reading everything on the case, looking through all the Josh, you're really loud.
Sorry.
Just to let you know.
Sorry.
So looking through all the newspaper clippings, and I remember seeing those headlines and seeing, you know, almost verbatim, missing family doesn't care about, family does not care about missing woman. And
terrible.
And I kind of believed it a little bit, only because I had read it so many times. So when we were in the van with her and she told us that story, that's the first I had heard of that. And I was like, oh, my gosh, of course, that makes absolute sense. That's what you're going to do for a loved one. If the police is ignoring you, if they're not taking a missing persons report, what's the next thing? Let me think. Well, the van was with her. Let me make that a missing person report. Maybe they'll at least go after the van, which is actually what happened. So absolutely tragic.
Right. But at the same time.
Go ahead, Josh.
Well, I was going to say, but at the same time, you know, we can't law enforcement's in a tough position because there's a lot of people who go missing because of drug dependency issues. So, you know, what do you do? Where do you draw the line? I mean, it's very easy to Monday morning quarterback the situation. I mean, look, I think one of the things that we're seeing here is that there's a problem with how it's reported, right, Rach?
Absolutely. I think a lot of it has to come down to the media as well. I do understand. Again, we always say how police are overworked and underpaid, and I understand a lot of people with addiction issues do go missing quite often, and it's hard to, you know, to track down every single person because sometimes they do pop up. However, I think it was the responsibility of the media to not portray victims in a negative light at all, you know, or the families in that, you know, in that aspect. So I think that was irresponsible for the media to portray it like that.
Right.
I do have a question, and this is one that comes up a lot, and I loathe to even ask this question, but everybody wants to know. Not everybody. A very large, loud minority wants to know, any satanic ritual, anything that you find in connection with these cases?
Josh, this is your question.
look, I look at a lot of satanic panic cases. You know, when you look at Cropsey, there's a ton of satanic panic in that case. That was the film that I did before. It just doesn't happen. It's a hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
It's whenever you bring in supernatural or something to that in a serial murder case, it's, you know, again, it's to sell newspapers. I think John Ray's very smart. And this is when I'm talking about John Ray, I'm talking about Shannon Gilbert's, the gentleman representing her estate. I think lawyer is great, but when you bring in the fact that Mary Gilbert may have practiced Wiccan, it has no bearing on this case. He's saying that maybe that was part of the reason that her daughter kind of lapsed in a schizophrenia. But to me, like, whenever I hear that, it just screams somebody's trying to just garner media attention. We've looked at so many occult ritualized abuse cases, and they're bogus. I'm sorry. There are a couple. I'm not saying that there's nothing, but very, very rarely is that what's going on. And, you know, it's interesting, and just to kind of break it down, there's a great book out there called Public Reactions to Serial Murder. And this gentleman is interviewed in our later episodes. When we can't catch a serial killer, when a serial killer eludes police, there has to be some logical reason why. And what we do is we end up saying that the reason why must be that this guy is better than the police. But we don't like to believe that anybody's better than the police. The police are there to protect us. So what we say is we start to prescribe that individual, you know, super intelligence, and that's where you get, like, the super, you know, intelligent Hannibal Lecter, or you get the serial killer who moves in and out of shadows. And basically, we prescribe them with supernatural kind of reasons, reasons why they're not caught. Or we kind of say that, oh, they must be police. Like, that's the logical reason why they're not caught. And, you know, it's funny. The only way to ever fight a serial murderer who has reached that, you'll see that they start to bring in psychics. And it's this idea of fighting supernatural with supernatural, fighting a dark figure with somebody who has, like, good magic versus black magic. And so it's just very interesting, and it's very something that we see a lot in serial killer cases, and it's a lot of hysteria, it's a lot of urban legend, and it's a lot of non-truths.
And like you said, it is all about just getting attention, and boy, nothing gets attention quicker than saying, hey, it's a satanic ritual killing. Everybody flocks to it, and so many people believe it, and it's like, come on, people. No. Okay. Should we wrap up episode 5 here? Have we missed anything that we'd like to go over before we move on to episode 6, which was wild beyond belief? So, okay, episode 6, A Killer on the Road. And I don't mean the last, but it was just like my head was spinning. There was so much going on, I don't even know where to start. Now, we do have on the phone with us Chief of Detectives at the Charleston Police Department in West Virginia, Steve Cooper. And we're going to talk a little bit, well, probably a lot, about Neil Falls. Now, he was a suspected serial killer who was killed by an escort, and you interviewed that escort. Broke my heart. She was so terrified, and she didn't want to kill him. She was left with no choice. So let's bring Chief Cooper in. Chief Cooper, are you with us?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, thank you, Chief Cooper. Welcome. It's Rachel and Josh, and my name's Tricia. And, Josh, let's just start with the beginning, episode 6, one of the wildest so far, okay?
Yep.
Neil Falls, let's just go from there. I'll let you take it from there.
Well, yeah, to back up, I guess, you know, we were looking at the 4 women murdered in Daytona, realized that it wasn't some kind of serialized murder, not like, you know, this was more probably having to do with motorcycle gangs and drugs and something like that. But what was interesting was the fact that a journalist from the Orlando Sentinel was able to kind of string together a bunch of murders that happened along the I-4 and along the Orange Blossom Trail Orlando and realized that there were, the MO was sort of the same, or the victimology, I should say, sex workers kind of all shot. And from that kind of deduced that there was an active serial killer in Florida, then went to the FBI. And the FBI, from that moment, admitted that they were looking at a number of serial murders. There was 28 in all, but they were specifically looking at 19 in Central Florida. And they then revealed, the journalist's name is Walter Pacheco, they revealed to him that there was something called the Highway Serial Killer Initiative. From that, we went to go see where that initiative was created in Oklahoma City through catching of a serial killer named John Robert Williams. And right at that moment, we were looking at basically what we call highly mobile serial killers. And then Neil Falls happens. And so we immediately jumped in the car and went to West Virginia. And that's where we met Steve Cooper. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Josh, how are you?
Good, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Very unusual case. It's great when a good guy gets to kill a bad guy. And that's what happened here with Neil Falls. Steve, Chief Cooper, are you positive that this guy has killed before? And can you link him to any murder specifically? How do we know Neil Falls was a serial killer?
Well, I'm not positive. I will say that Neil Falls was a 45-year-old man who has predatory instincts, had predatory instincts. He showed up at Heather's home in Charleston with four sets of handcuffs in his pocket, a loaded firearm, numerous cutting utensils, a shovel, a tub large enough for a woman to fit inside of, axes, hatchets, bleach, trash bags, and bad intentions. And he had a list of women on a piece of paper in his pocket, all of whom were on Backpage, which the killing season has covered pretty well. The women who are on Backpage who are many times victimized or hunted by some of these predators, there's easy access. They have a very limited support system with their families and friends. And Mr. Falls had what we call, we refer to as a serial killer's kit in the back of his vehicle.
And so have you connected him to anything?
Crimes, as far as being linked to other crimes, he lived in Henderson, Nevada. In the mid-2000s when four sex workers who were advertising online all disappeared. And most of them were found, some of their body parts were found in other states where Mr. Falls had been stopped by law enforcement, Illinois for one. There's an interesting news story on Fox 5 or in Las Vegas that I think Rachel posted. For all to see, they interviewed some of his coworkers. He was Mr. Falls was known to frequent prostitutes, to frequent deserted areas, and to torture animals.
God, Rachel, you interviewed Heather, the escort that killed Neil Falls. You and Josh did both, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Give us your thoughts on that. How did it feel? I bet she just came across as so sympathetic.
She was very sympathetic. she was, and it was a difficult interview. It had literally just happened, I would say, a week, maybe 2 weeks prior to. I think she was just off of being out of shock, to be quite frank. I think there was a lot of media onslaught, and she wasn't prepared for it. And wasn't talking to too many people. And luckily, I think that we approached her in a way that she felt comfortable in speaking with us. But, you know, when we talked to Cooper and Mary Claire Akers, who will be on with us soon, you know, it's not just happening in Charleston, West Virginia, but it's across the country is the opioid epidemic, which is extremely tragic. And Heather herself, you know, says that she escorts to support her habit and her lifestyle and her house. You know, she's paying rent. So she is caught in a tough situation, right? And there are people like Neil Falls who will take advantage of that. What's interesting for me is to think, you know, has he done this before? Could this just be his first time? I saw those implements. I was there in the police station looking at that axe, looking at, you know, that tub. I mean, there's a chance that was the first time he's ever tried to do that. And his intention was to get away with it. And then maybe he would have moved on to the other five, I think it was five women that he had listed. Who knows? But I think a lot of people out there do believe that Heather saved future women's lives.
Sure.
I think that is very important. And I'm very happy that she was able to get away and really was, it was instinctual, you know, on her part.
Hey, Steve, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If you can really reveal it. The other women, were they all local to Charleston?
No, most of them were, but there was actually at least one woman who was from California.
Really?
And California. And Mr. Falls actually lived in Oregon. And he had been fired from a security guard's position there for stalking and threatening a sex worker at the hotel that he was working at. but one that actually happened to him more than once in Oregon. But
really?
You know, there was a girl from California who was on Backpage. He was going to public libraries and using the internet service there.
Right.
It appeared to me based, at least in part to avoid detection.
Right.
And we were able to track some of that back, and he had contacted some of the women. Some of them had actually said they were going to strike a deal with him to meet, but some of the things he said actually startled them. And he
really?
Approached. Yeah, he had startled them with some of the dialogue, and they terminated communication with him. We actually found a couple of sex workers that worked on street corners here in Charleston who had been harassed by him the night before. They actually had approached his vehicle for a potential date, and they say his demeanor and some of the things he said, they didn't get into the details. They didn't want to talk much about it. It actually caused one of them to actually run away from him.
Really? That's strange. Yeah. You we talk about that sixth sense that, you know, some of the girls in the street have leaning into the car, looking around the car versus, you know, talking on the phone. You don't have that, you know, that visual communication.
Heather actually gave him directions step by step to get to her home. She talked to him, basically guided him into her neighborhood and all the way to her back door.
Right. And
I'm sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, Josh. Sorry to interrupt.
Let's bring in
Marie Claire Akers. She is the prosecutor from the Charleston area, West Virginia. And Ms. Akers, thank you for joining us tonight. We appreciate you holding.
Sure. Thanks for having us on.
We love having you on, believe me. Now, West Virginia, Charleston, you know, that could be any city, USA. You have a problem there that Rachel mentioned earlier, and that's the opioid addiction problem. And it's not just with sex workers. Everybody thinks it's with sex workers, but it's not. But you see this a lot. In West Virginia, how bad is that problem?
West Virginia has one of the worst opioid addiction rates in the nation. People come here routinely, journalists, and do stories about it. The opioid epidemic swept through here, through most of our southern counties very quickly, and it's just spread across our state. And you can't, I don't think you can find a person who is from here who can't tell you some way that addiction has touched them. It's a family member, a friend, a neighbor, an uncle, I mean, somebody that they went to school with. It's just everywhere.
And I think interesting is, you know, like some, well, we're in New York, but that opioid addiction problem is pretty prevalent in one of our five boroughs, Staten Island, New York. I think it's a little kind of maybe shocking to some of the folks, you know, here who don't know about this. You've been dealing with this for how long?
We started dealing with it, I would say, and we started seeing it, I would say, almost 10 years ago now. Pills were easily accessible. We had a lot of what we call pill mills here with doctors that shouldn't have been prescribing, that were prescribing in mass amounts for cash money. And then that very quickly turned to heroin because, obviously, heroin is much cheaper. That is what has really fueled a lot of it. And, it's you know, so far it's not been something that we've been able to successfully defeat.
How has that addiction level changed in terms of, like, what happens after 10 years? Like, what do you do?
And that, it's sitting to think about it, the only way I believe to cure it is to approach it as a public health issue and not a law enforcement issue.
Right.
My job is to enforce the law, and sometimes that includes putting people in jail. We do have a lot of alternative programs for people who are addicted that are commit, and this is one of the things that brings it out, is just a rash of property crime everywhere. So we created a lot of drug courts to try to deal with offenders who are mainly stealing to support their habit. But it's not a crime I have that is not related to drugs in some way.
But what about the women? You know, our show looks at, you know, these women who are becoming victims. They're kind of the drugs are, you know, lowering some of the barriers of entry, you know, forcing some of these women to do things that they wouldn't normally do. I mean, that's different from, you know, people who are more advocates. I mean, you know, I'm trying to separate out, you know, professional sex worker from somebody who's doing it to kind of feed their addictions. And that's what we had here. You know, Heather wouldn't have been, or I don't know, maybe she would have, but I doubt she would have been on Backpage. Is Backpage, like, part of the problem?
Obviously it is, because Backpage is something that I think everyone recognizes as being associated with sex workers and the trading of sex. I mean, obviously that exists, and when I hear Backpage and it comes up, it's always something like that. It's always something bad. So, do I think it's part of the problem? I guess, but in this age, we're in the information age. If there's not Backpage, then it's going to be social media form. I mean, that's just where we are, and I don't think, getting rid of those things is probably not going to help, because something else will just show up in its place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what do we do? What can we do? Ooh, I'm sorry, Rach, go ahead.
I think, and I've been watching your show and thinking about the things that you guys are talking about with all of the women that just vanish and disappear, and it's a staggering amount. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really unbelievable. And I realize there seems to be no centralized database for anybody who has disappeared, or at least listing known relatives or people that they might be related to. And sure, it looks like there are places to go and look for people, but it's kind of a height, weight, date of birth kind of thing. You have to put hometowns and maybe possible relatives so that you can have a little bit more information to try to figure out what's happened to these people.
Mm-hmm.
That's really awesome. But as far as solving the drug problem, like I said, I think that's a treatment issue and a public health issue, and it's certainly challenging. If I knew how to do it, I would be out there doing it, because it leads to a lot of the stuff that you all are talking about on your show. And you're talking about Heather. Heather's very open about who she is and what she does. She's never lied about it. She's always, she explains to me that she's addicted in a way that a lot of people have been. She was prescribed opioids by a doctor who shouldn't have been prescribing them to her. And then the doctor got busted. And he was a well-known doctor around this region who ended up in prison. His name was Dr. Durakshan. And after he was busted, she had no source of supply, so she turned to heroin. Happened to a lot of people that were addicted from bad doctors. And,
you know,
Go ahead. Yeah, no, I was going to say, I think that this has come up sometimes from maybe people who haven't watched the show or maybe people who have, kind of having not so much of empathy for people who turn to sex work or people who are in the sex industry or even addicts themselves or people who have substance abuse issues. And I think in the show, you said it very eloquently that I think that a lot of us have been touched. Maybe we don't even know it by people who have substance issues, especially with opioids and heroin. And so I think that it's easy to for people to feel like it doesn't touch them and to look down on them. But I think, again, you said it so eloquently in the show that it has touched so many people.
And I'm not sure if I said it on the show. I can't remember. But everybody kind of doesn't believe this, but, you know, many people are pretty much one step away from something like this happening. And I've seen many people addicted so quickly and so easily, and it's not something you can predict. One person may be able to recreationally take opioids, and that person's brother or sister becomes an addict in 3 days. And then their life spirals out of control. The people who love them can't reach them. They turn in, you know, their personalities are very different and their families don't know what to do. And it's really sad because it is everywhere. And I guess people can look down on what you would consider someone who's hard luck or a sex worker. But, you know, many of them, and there are people who work in sex work because it's a choice, but the people I deal with, they're not there as a result of a conscious choice. They're there because a lot of things haven't gone their way in life and they've ended up addicted to drugs. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that it's wrong for people to view it that way. Everyone, you know, everyone's
right.
Life is important.
And I can guarantee everybody here, you know somebody who is an opiate addict. They just haven't told you. So don't think it's just sex workers, because it is not. Steve Cooper, Chief of Detectives, I have a question for you from one of our Web Sleuths members, if I could maybe turn the topic a little bit here. A lot of people have asked that the serial killer, truckers, you know, that's a big thing, because truckers can easily become serial killers and nobody will ever discover them. Could it be that there's a trucker serial killer out there, maybe with a couple of women working with him? I mean, there's all kinds of different scenarios, and I'm sure you see a lot of the sex workers and the problems with the truckers. What do you think?
Well, we have an area in Charleston where there's a large truck stop, and I want to emphasize that 99% of truckers are hardworking, backbone of America type guys and gals, and the salt of the earth type people. And they're many times very helpful when it comes to pointing us in the right direction if there's a sex crime or something that happens there. But we've had incidents at the truck stop, and again, it's a very large truck stop. There have been juveniles who have actually been rented out or sold to a trucker by a relative.
No.
That happened in Charleston a few years ago, and we caught the guy, and he went to prison, and all those involved. But there are certainly serial killers that traffic in areas like that, because truck stops are sometimes high prostitution areas. It's a small number of truckers, but it's lucrative for the girls. The prostitutes, the sex workers, they gravitate toward areas where there are large numbers of men who may be by themselves, who may be working late at night. And, again, the sex workers, as Ms. Baker said, they are not – most of them are very unhappy in the lifestyle that they're stuck in. They're lonely. They don't have their family. Many times their families have not necessarily abandoned them, but they've done so much harm to their families through theft and pain that they just don't have those support systems. But to answer your question, absolutely it's possible that people are working in concert together somewhere in the country when it comes to murder or sexual assault or kidnapping. Nothing really surprises when it comes to sex crimes or whenever these are predatory criminals. They're not going to target and kidnapping moms of three who are leaving the soccer field and buying a gallon of milk. They're going to areas where the victims are easy prey.
Yeah. Hey, Steve, can I ask you a question? Have
sure.
you, in reaching out to other law enforcement agencies about Neil Falls, have you learned anything new?
We know that the investigation in Las Vegas is still ongoing, and any information that's been shared with me by other law enforcement on an active investigation would be something that I wouldn't be able to elaborate on. But I can tell you that I can tell you there's a good bit of interest in Mr. Falls. As much research and investigation is being done as is possible. And, you know, when time goes by and decomposition sets in with victims, sometimes DNA is not necessarily a silver bullet. So they're doing the best they can. They do care about the case. I've communicated with them. I've communicated with Long Island. I've communicated with officials in Texas where Mr. Falls was actually stopped right before he came to West Virginia.
Right.
I've probably spoken to 20 different law enforcement agencies, and the FBI is assisting us also.
Oh, they are. Okay. And you cannot tell us what the connection was to Long Island, correct?
There's nothing concrete. We have spoken with Long Island, and there's an aspect of the investigation that's interesting as far as the Long Island case goes.
Right.
But there's nothing concrete, and certainly until there would be something that would connect the dots, I don't think anyone would be able to speak publicly about that.
And is there anything that you've learned kind of, you know, in your own just, you know, kind of in this whole Neil Falls thing? Like, what have you learned?
About Mr. Falls or about...
No. Kind of just in terms of as an investigator. You know?
Sure. You know, as we've discussed all evening here, and as Mary Claire said earlier, this case was so full of dark aspects. You know, the way that it happened, the way that Heather was targeted, the things that we learned dealing with Heather in a case where a victim actually survived and the bad guy actually died, has, you know, it's taught me some things about being a victim, about what a victim goes through during the commission of a crime like that. Because typically, when Mary Claire and I show up at a crime scene, the victim is dead, not the suspect.
Right.
So in this case, we were actually able to get a description from a victim of what this type of crime was like. Normally, we just have to reconstruct it. In this case, we've worked it from, instead of from backward forward, we've worked it from the suspect being dead backward. So it's been it's very unique.
Oh, that's interesting. That's very interesting.
Yep.
How is Heather doing? Have you all talked to her?
I haven't talked to her in several months. The last time that I talked to her, she was in good spirits. She keeps to herself quite a bit. She still has, the last time I talked to her, she still has some post-traumatic stress from it. She still has some nightmares about it. She was obviously, she was traumatized not only by the experience, but she was traumatized by the fact that she took a life. But again, as Mary Claire said on numerous occasions, Heather saved somebody else's life, probably more than one woman. I don't believe, based on Mr. Falls' M.O. and based on all those sinister items that he had with him, I find it very hard to believe that this was his first time based on his age and those other factors.
Right. Well, thank you very much, guys. Much appreciated. It's wonderful speaking to you.
Thanks very much.
Hey, thanks
thank
for
you.
Having me.
Thank you, and we're getting a hold of Heather here, and just not Heather, the prostitute, but our next guest will be Heather, oh, I've got to find her name. Anyway, she is a writer for Sword and Scale, Heather Sutphin, and she also has a blog on Neil Falls, and Bessie will be getting in touch with her for just a moment. But I found that a very fascinating conversation with the prosecutor and the police chief of police of detectives, that is, Steve Cooper and Marie-Claire Akers. It just sounds like West Virginia actually has it worse than a lot of places in America. I was thinking maybe they're kind of like just the perfect example, but it sounds like with the sex case workers and the opiate addiction, it's like ground zero. It's big there. It's huge, and it's a major problem.
Yeah. I mean, like, we didn't really push too much, and we didn't, you know, sensationalize or elaborate. I think, you know, they are trying not to, you know, kind of down, you know, they don't want to speak ill will about their town, but it is rough there. But then again, you know, in New York City, we have Staten Island, and in Vermont and New Hampshire, they have incredible opioid epidemics. You know, it's bad all over. And one of the unfortunate things about addiction and about this type of addiction is that unfortunately it leads people to do things they would normally never do, not to be gender specific, but, you know, it leads some women to, engage in sex work, you know, and the unfortunate problem is it creates a huge victim pool. And in a lot of ways, I'm not a professional, but I think what it does is it creates such a big victim pool that maybe guys who wouldn't normally like consider it, just, you know, consider it. You know, there's a couple things that have to happen, and that's one of them, you know, a lot of victims.
Yeah, and that is very, very unfortunate. Okay, I believe, Bessie, do we have Heather on the line with us? I believe so.
Hey,
Can I just interject?
Yeah. And we don't like
Please
to
do.
Use the word prostitute. I say always sex worker. That's from everyone that I've spoken to who's in that industry and who's in that line of work. I think it's very important to respect that. And I think it's easy for us to kind of fall into what media portrays with in the media, they're lucky if they're called prostitutes. And they're sometimes called whores and hookers. And that's atrocious. And I don't like it at all. As far as, you know, moving forward, I'd love to just sex worker or just use your name.
Let me just tell you real quickly, I got a very impassioned email from a sex worker begging me not to use the phrase sex worker because she said it's demeaning to everybody. So,
really?
You know, I guess obviously hooker is it's a terrible word, you know, and so you don't use those.
So
absolutely
can I ask
not.
You a
but,
question?
Yeah.
Why did they not want to use the word sex worker?
According to this woman, and she sounds legit, that it sounded very kind of low class, you know, not very high class. She liked to escort or I think she even said prostitute, if I'm not mistaken. But
really?
She said sex worker, her and her group, they hate that word because it sounds, I don't know, kind of like minimum wage digging ditches thing, you know. It's just very, very low class. So I guess it
That's interesting. We try and keep it clinical without any, you know, we pick sex worker because it's just so clinical. You know, there's no judgment there. You know, it just straight up is what it is. So that's interesting.
Exactly. So very interesting. Okay, I'll tell you, we have our guest now on the line. This is Heather Sutphin, and Heather writes for our great podcast called Sword and Scale. And also, Heather, you know a lot about Neil Falls because you have a blog on him, correct?
Yes, I do. Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, Heather.
How you doing, Rachel?
Good.
So tell us about your blog. Tell us your thoughts on Neil Falls. I mean, I'm so glad this guy got what he deserved. Unfortunately, it took the other Heather to do it, and now she's traumatized for life. But she did save Lord knows how many women. Tell us what you know about Neil.
Okay, so I don't know anything concrete. I mean, like everybody else in this case, we've just been trying to follow the leads. I started with the murdered and missing women in Chillicothe, and that's what dragged me into the case and my interest in it. And it's just kind of grown from there, and I'm trying to connect the dots. As of right now, I'm really looking at the murders in Vegas. I think there's some strong leads there.
Yeah.
And possibly some murders in Texas, I hear, but I know nothing concrete about that.
Right. Can I ask you a question? You know, because you brought up Chillicothe, and the same trip that we went to West Virginia, we also went to Chillicothe. We went there because everybody was saying the word serial killer, and we weren't so sure. So what do you think?
I don't think it was any sort of serial case in Chillicothe, to tell you the truth. I think there was a lot of stuff going on there. I think there's a lot of drugs there and all of the unsavory things that go along with that sort of lifestyle, the prostitution and, you know, these kind of mean, nasty gangbangers and things like that. And I think people just getting caught up in that lifestyle and paying the price because of it. And
right.
I don't think it's necessarily a serial killer case per se. I think maybe some of these women were killed over business reasons, like they were going to go to the police, or maybe they knew too much about the wrong people and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it was amazing. Rachel and I got into town. Our first interview was with the mayor, and the mayor says, you know, it's no serial killer, right? It's, you know, it's drugs. You know, the whole town is addicted to heroin. And we said, well, you know, we can believe that, since 4 hours south was, you know, the whole thing with Neil Falls. What upsets me is the media portrayal of trying to push a serial killer narrative when there is none. And calling it a serial killer. And all these people descending upon this town and calling it a serial killer when it's not. It's drugs. But nobody wants to hear that story. Because why? Because that story isn't sexy enough, or it's too institutionalized, but there's nothing we can do because there's no bad guy. I mean, it really pisses me off.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, it's awful, and it's awful to these families, too. It's doing them a great injustice to make them think, or make the public think one thing when they know it's a very different story.
And so, look, you're in the media. You cover crime. You know, and trust me, I'm not like I'm not some kind of saint, you know, true crime saint, you know, but at the same time, where's the responsibility, you know, in saying, like, I'm sorry, folks, there's no serial killer here. It's about drugs and our opiate problem. But of course, that's not sexy enough, and that's more for CNN, and we cover crime, and it's bullshit. It really upsets me.
And once you start digging in these cases, I mean, it's very glaringly obvious. Some of these women were definitely overdoses, just somebody didn't want to get caught with their body. So they took them out to the woods and left them there. And it's
right,
awful.
It doesn't take Sherlock Holmes to figure that out.
That's what happened.
Right. So where do you draw the line? Like, you're a journalist, you know, you have a podcast, you cover true crime. What's the ethical responsibility here?
I guess I don't really have an answer for that. I mean, on the one hand, you know, you want people to listen to your podcast, you want people to read your articles, things like that. But at the same time, you don't want to sit there and lie to people or just sensationalize for the sake of sensationalism either.
Yeah.
I don't think that does anybody any sort of justice.
Well, I think you're right about it kind of re-victimizing the families, like leading them to believe that there may be something else going on, and then losing faith in law enforcement. That's really unfortunate.
That's certainly unfortunate.
Now, can I ask you a question? Rachel and I, we had a fleeting suspicion, And Rachel, why don't you ask the question that nobody else wants to ask?
I don't know. But what was that question? Why don't you go ahead? I'm not sure what it is.
There could be. It could be that Neil Falls has never killed again, killed before, correct?
Mm.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my suspicions, actually, because I've been looking at him very seriously in the Vegas murders, but there's a strong suggestion that it could be that these women's boyfriends who acted as their pimps killed them.
Right.
And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that as well. So you have to look at everything. You have to say, well, did this guy do it? And if not, who did?
Right. Now, in the Las Vegas case, do you know that case well enough just to kind of give the 20,000 foot kind of description of it?
I'm sorry, what's the question again? Sorry.
In the Las Vegas case, because a lot of people aren't going to know what that is. Do you know the generalities of the case?
Oh, okay. Well, initially, three women. It was Lindsay Harris, Jody Brewer, and Misty Sains. They were all abducted, and then they were dismembered and left along the highway. One was left north of Vegas. One was left at the California border in some kind of national park there. And then Lindsay Harris, all of her body has not been found, but they did find her legs in Illinois.
Huh.
And
right.
So if it wasn't a trucker or this Neil Falls character, then there's a good possibility, since all of the women were working on the streets as escorts, that they could have been killed by people they made mad. Maybe they wanted to leave the lifestyle.
Do you believe Neil Falls is responsible for those murders?
I think there's a good possibility.
Mm-hmm.
He was definitely living in the area at the time, and just through conversations I've had with people who knew him during that time period, they said he was very strange. He talked about prostitutes a lot. I think Steve Cooper told you a lot of this stuff already, that he was just a very strange man. So there's a good possibility he liked prostitutes, he lived in the area, he liked to mutilate animals. Maybe he did do something to these girls. It's a possibility. And we would never know because he would have no real link to them outside of just picking them up one night for a date and they're never seen again.
Right.
So it's hard to tell.
Hmm. Interesting.
Heather, give us the address of your blog. That's one thing that we've never gotten yet from you. How do people find your blog?
How do people find my blog? Usually people just type in... Oh, I'm sorry. Neil Falls Investigation .wordpress.com.
There you go. Perfect. I'm sorry, Rachel, were you about to ask a question?
No. I'm glad you asked that question. So what, we're at 9 o'clock right now?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll tell you what, Heather, thank you so much. You've been wonderful, and we'll put the link up to your blog on Web Sleuths as well, and you've offered a different perspective. I'm glad to hear somebody say that maybe Neil Falls didn't kill anybody else. This could be his first time. So thank you, Heather. Thank you so much. We'll have you on again
Can I say one thing? Is that Heather was the first person, when the Neil Falls story hit, Heather was the first person I went to because she had an incredible Facebook page, and she knew any more than anybody out there. So if you want to know more about Neil Falls, join her Facebook page because she is constantly posting. If something breaks, that'll be the first place you'll see it.
Oh, yeah, I'm constantly on it.
And you can also read my other work on Sword and Scale. I do follow up occasionally on there as well.
Great.
Cool.
Thank you.
Sustan, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you so much, Heather.
And
thanks for
we'll
having me
We'll have you
on
again soon, I'm sure. You bet.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Josh and Rachel, we're going to go now to one of my favorite people with the most amazing project, the Murder Accountability Project. And the genius behind it, one of the geniuses, is Tom Hargrove. And Tom, welcome to Web Sleuth Radio. You're on with Josh and Rachel.
Well, hi, everyone. Lovely
hey,
to be
friend.
With you.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Tom, why don't you go ahead and tell us what the Murder Accountability Project is? Just start off right off the bat with that.
Okay. What we're trying to do is to create greater transparency in what happens with homicides in the United States. And so part of that job is to assemble what is, without dispute, the most complete list of homicide victims, homicide cases in the United States. We've assembled records on more than 700,000 murders committed since 1976. Part of that includes, most of that comes from the FBI's supplementary homicide report. The FBI has been great and has given us every record they have on supplemental data for homicides. We've augmented those records with more than 22,000 murders that were never reported to the Justice Department. We've used Freedom of Information Act laws and
what?
Have acquired
22,000.
That's correct.
How does that
participation?
Happen?
Yeah, participation in federal crime reporting is entirely voluntary. No police department is required, in most states anyway, to report that a murder occurred or whether the murder was cleared. It is a voluntary program, and so we're trying to make it mandatory. We first of all encourage all police departments to report crime data to the Justice Department, and we urge state legislatures to make such reporting mandatory. But it isn't. It is not mandatory, and frankly, we can see where the unreported bodies are buried, and there are thousands of unreported cases. And we're going as quickly as possible, state by state, large city by large city, trying to acquire your missing murder cases. We're just completing a lengthy lawsuit against the Illinois State Police. Illinois is the largest jurisdiction that fails to report any data to the supplementary homicide report or to track homicide clearances. Nobody in Illinois has any idea how often a murder gets cleared. And so we're trying to encourage them to make changes.
It's funny, Tricia, and every time I speak to Tom, you know, obviously he's on the show, but every time he brings up this subject, I'm speechless. You know, I just don't get it. How, Tom, can this happen?
It comes down to the political realities of law enforcement. The United States has started out as a collection of individual states, and we still are. Homicide is a local crime. It is investigated by the city or the county where the murder occurred. There is no other oversight beyond that. So if a police department fails at solving a murder, that ends it. There's no real state, in most places, there is no state oversight, and there certainly is no natural jurisdiction for the federal government to review failed murders. And there is no requirement that that cities report those failed murders. And that's where we come in. We're trying to document as much as possible the rate at which murders do not get solved and the rate at which they might be solved if there were a complete accounting made. We go around the country to gatherings of homicide detectives, and we give demonstrations on how the data that we've assembled could be useful for them, especially when they think they're chasing an offender who has killed across multiple jurisdictions. It's a cheap way because it's free. It's an inexpensive way for police to test theories if they have a timeline on a suspect they can go to the various places where that suspect has lived and look to see if there are unsolved killings that match the pattern they think he is guilty of in their jurisdiction. There really is no place to do that other than us. There is no master list of murder in the United States, and that's precisely what we're trying to assemble.
And if I may, I just think it's ridiculous. Not ridiculous, but it's just crazy to me that a citizen, you are a citizen, a private citizen who has compiled the most comprehensive database of murder in the United States. Is that correct?
That's correct. I agree with you. This should be a government function. And I can speak for all of my colleagues with the Murder Accountability Project. We would be very happy if Congress would put us out of business. But that doesn't seem likely to happen anytime soon. So we're it. If you want to find a murder that occurred in Seattle and you're a cop in Albuquerque, you pretty much need to go to our website at murderdata.org and you can find those records.
Right.
Beyond that, it's not a simple matter.
Now, can you, you know, again, some of this we address in the show, but can you give us an example, real-world example, of how this has played itself out, even outside of Gary, Indiana, which we mentioned in the show?
Yeah, so I can give you an example from yesterday because of your show. And by the way, we had a former prostitute contact us from rural Virginia and say that she had an experience 23 years ago, and she described the experience, and it really sounded like she was very lucky to be alive. She was working as a prostitute and was picked up by a 45-year-old white man with a round face who seemed very pleasant, and so she took a chance and got in his van, and he drove her to his home and took her upstairs and took her into a bedroom with no furniture, but there was a collar affixed to a chain affixed to the ceiling, and he put the collar on her. The room was lined with guns and ammunition, and she really thought she was going to die. She survived because she told the guy that she was pregnant. She was pregnant with her second, what would turn out to be her second daughter. And I guess even serial killers or potential serial killers have rules sometimes, and he was not going to do whatever he was going to do to her, to a pregnant woman, so he let her go. So she contacted us, and we looked at the area where she was living and looked at the timeline when this occurred, and then contacted local police to advise them that there were two or three homicides that seemed to be victimology similar to the prostitute and who could have been his successful victims. We'll see if anything comes of that. But the ability to be able to quickly call up records anywhere in the United States to see if you have a particular victimology for victims whose cases were not solved. I mean, that's extremely useful. And we'll see. Maybe something will come of this, maybe not. But sooner or later, having a data set like this is going to solve some crimes. It may already have, and we just don't know about it. We've been in operation for a little less than 2 years. But it can be powerful to be able to query homicide records everywhere and look for a specific kind of unsolved murder.
Well, I have a question. How in the world did you get started with this?
Yeah, so I'm a retired investigative journalist. I'm also a retired White House correspondent. I hated that job. That's a terrible job. but being an investigative journalist is just the most fun you can have. And back in 2010, in my final years in journalism, I was able to convince my editors to let me take a look at unsolved murders in the United States. And the first part of that, of course, is to find out how many they were. And so we immediately started assembling records from the Uniform Crime Report, an FBI data system, and the Supplementary Homicide Report, which is case-level details of every murder. And at the time, we realized that there were 185,000 unsolved murders in the United States. Today, there are more than 220,000 unsolved murders. And we discovered that the rate at which murders get solved varies alarmingly. In recent years, we only solve about, well, less than two-thirds. Last year, we solved 61% of our murders. That is to say, an arrest was made in 61%. I'm sure the rate of conviction was considerably lower than that. But there are many places in America where most murders go unsolved. And the more we looked at that, the more I realized that I could probably spend the rest of my life doing this, trying to assemble adequate records so that we could track the rate at which murders get solved, and case-level records that might be an asset to local police. Part of that project back in 2010, it became horribly obvious how few resources police are given. Again, they don't have a master list to go by. There is no central repository of murder archived by any government. And so I told myself that when I retired, which was the early last year, I would spend the rest of my days doing this. And so we are. We've established a wonderful board of directors, many of them former FBI investigators, or others with criminal investigative backgrounds. We have criminologists. We have a few former journalists. And we do the best we can trying to gather records that should have been reported all along but often aren't.
You know, after episode 6 aired this past Saturday, you know, I've been on Twitter all week essentially. I've been getting messages on Web Sleuth and Facebook and Twitter. And the thing that keeps resonating with people is the outrage they feel, not just for the women, because that's definitely the case, but that I think, myself included, when I first went into this series, is not knowing that that database was so fractured, that homicide data was not mandated to be reported to VICAP by any of the 20,000 different law enforcement agencies around the country. And the message I kept getting from people is, what can we do? What can we do? So much so that there was people who are starting to, like, create a petition to petition the federal government to make mandatory reporting into VICAP. What would you say to people who are, you know, in any town USA to feel like they're doing something to help make a difference?
First, I would say go to murderdata.org and look up what the murder solution rate is for your city and your county and your state. Find out how often murders are solved. If the answer isn't good, and quite often it isn't, then start to have a conversation with your local politicians. Tell the mayor that you find a 50% solution rate to be unacceptable. And that's the way it is in most major American cities, 50, 55%. Start there, but also, we definitely need better records maintenance. We need better participation by police in cooperation with the FBI. I'll sign that petition, frankly. I mean, we already have gone on record as believing that if a murder has gone unsolved after a year, then it should be mandatory that it shall be reported to VICAP. I mean,
that sounds good.
Yeah, but again, all roads lead to Congress. Nothing's going to happen unless it's made a national law. And, you know, very little is happening. And this would be a rather major change in how police departments operate if they are required to report information to the Justice Department. There'll be a lot of pushback to that, frankly. It is not. It would be viewed by many as encroachment in the sovereignty of local law enforcement. Which I can understand. I mean, we are not looking to allow Big Brother to control how homicides are investigated. But we sure need something, and we sure need better transparency for the rate at which murders are failed and which murders are failed. There are dreadful patterns to the kinds of murders that are and are not solved. Yeah.
But there's – I watch TV every day. Maybe not every day, but and every time I go on, there's always a situation room or something where like guys are putting in all these information and they have algorithms and they're pulling up connections and all this stuff. And you're telling me that that doesn't happen.
That doesn't happen. No, no. I mean, it should. It'd be nice. It would be comforting to know that there are vast intelligences watching over us. And in some ways there are. I mean, don't get me wrong. The Homeland Security Department is trying to be as sophisticated as it can in its response to terrorism. But
sure.
For the rank and file everyday killing in America, no.
But why
not? It's because
shouldn't we start with that?
It's just not the way we have ever done things. And it's very difficult to overcome the central inertia of crime reporting. Basically, murder is a local incident, and it stays local.
But why does the media continue to put this BS story out every time, every show?
Well, I don't think the news media does.
No. It's like the CSIs,
Well, because I'm afraid people who write for crime shows don't necessarily know a whole lot about the realities of law enforcement, or at least they know that that wouldn't make a very good story. Who would want to watch Law and Order if half the murders on Law and Order were not solved?
True.
That'd be bad for ratings, and nothing can allow us not to go for ratings. You know, it's just the nature. We want a Hollywood ending in life, and so often we don't get that in reality. But reality won't help sell commercials.
So one thing, two quick questions. One, is there a reason why they don't want to report? I mean, is there a more like they don't, because then we can use the data against them to say, hey, you guys aren't doing your job.
Yeah. Well, there are several things at work. First of all, data reporting is difficult. It requires resources and time and personnel to enter the data.
Right.
Secondly, though, you've got that issue of, do I really want to be accountable? Do I really want to tell the world that I'm solving only a third of my murders, which is what's happening in Chicago? Chicago does not report clearances to the FBI. Chicago is the nation's largest center of homicide. They have more homicides than any police department in the United States, and they haven't reported clearance data to the Justice Department for 22 years, which is why we went to court in Illinois.
That's ridiculous.
And we're still not done with Illinois, but we're doing what we can. So there's a reluctance. Why tell the world bad news? Especially bad news about me, and so you know you've got that going on too, and it's human nature. Also, there is a genuine anti-federal nerve in America. We don't like Big Brother. We don't like Uncle Sam nosing into our private affairs, even if it's murder.
But this is murder.
Yeah, I know. It's terrible. But
this is not.
So you're up against all kinds
gun.
of political reality.
This is murder.
Yeah.
So one of the great things, and I want to thank you, and I want to thank Tricia, because you guys have gotten together, and you know we are for kind of power to the people. We are for letting letting there be transparency. And so what you guys have done, have gotten together, and now the Murder Accountability Project can also be used by Web Sleuth members. Of course, it can be used by anybody. But now there's a link right on the Web Sleuth site for a lot of the Web Sleuthers.
Oh, yeah, it's great. And we've seen lots of traffic from Web Sleuths. Thank you very much for doing that, Tricia. That's
no,
lovely.
You're welcome, Tom.
And yeah,
I just
want to
say one thing.
Can I
just say one thing? I want to call absolute baloney on any other reason that law enforcement gives other than what you said a bit earlier, Tom, is they don't want to show their poor rate of solving a crime. And to me, that is bull. There should be an outrage over that. Why this hasn't been taken care of before is beyond me. It's so simple. Everybody reports the murders, the solved murders, and then they can all work together, and gosh, maybe they could even solve more murders. To me, any other excuse is absolute crap. It's just because they don't want their stats to be up there and for the world to see. And, you know, tough. Oh, well, do better if you don't want your stats up there. Okay, I'm off my soapbox. Thank you, Tom. We love having you on.
Well,
we're getting,
all
we're getting
I can say to that
response.
Is amen.
We're getting a great response, and I foresee Web Sleuth members using your site constantly very soon here. And that's a great thing. I didn't know about the Murder Accountability Project until Josh and Rachel told me. So
right.
Let's get you out there and get everybody using it, and then maybe we can have that groundswell of support to get a law in there to force these people to report just exactly what happens.
Yeah. There's a magic to counting things. And if there's something you don't want, count it and count it right. And
yeah.
Make sure everyone knows about that. And that's all we're really trying to do is to document. But I'm astonished at the community that Web Sleuths has put together. It's vibrant and passionate, and boy, it warms the cockles of our nerdly hearts to see so many of you guys out there trolling the FBI data and testing theories.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. So we commend
and
you and thank you so much for linking to us. We appreciate that.
Absolutely. Our goal is to warm the cockles of nerds' hearts. That's kind of our mantra. So.
There you go.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
Well, Trish, one thing, we are going to be seeing Tom in episode 8.
I can't wait. That's going to be great.
Yeah. And so
can we
let's say this, the ride with Tom is not over yet.
Can we get a little hint of what he's going to be involved with exactly?
Sure. So we have revealed that we are going to be going back to Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of tragic, but it does answer a lot of questions. It also brings up more questions. But, you know, one of the things that is very important to us is about, again, actioning. Allowing people to kind of control their own destinies. It's not just, hey, there's a bunch of serial killers roaming the United States and, you know, everyone lock your doors. That would be irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
What we're here to do is, hey, there's a bunch of serial killers roaming the United States. Let's find them. And so with Tom's help, that's one of the things we will do and maybe we will continue to do. So looking for everybody to please, you know, stay tuned for 7 and 8 and to go on to the Murder Accountability Project. It's a little daunting, by the way, but, you know, like QuickBooks or Excel or any of the other programs that we've managed to do and even change the numbers on your VCR, you can figure it out. And you can find some very, very interesting data.
Yeah, if I could, often serial killers, if they're active enough, leave a statistical trace. And so we've tried to make it visually obvious when something way bad wrong is happening with the murder patterns in a community.
Mm-hmm.
We've also created an algorithm. That's why Josh came to us to begin with. We've created an algorithm that can go through the FBI data and pull out highly suspicious clusters of killing that look like they could easily be from a common killer. And so we applied that algorithm, and that's what you'll see work in the final episode. So we really appreciate Josh and Rachel and their team testing the algorithm and going to a place where there might be a previously unknown serial killer.
Can I ask a question, Tom? Very quickly,
sure.
Just because there's going to be a lot of people trying out the site for the first time. What are some of the pitfalls? Because I don't think what we want to have happen is a lot of people think that they've found a serial killer and then just kind of rush out and call law enforcement.
Oh boy, I'm not sure I would want to discourage that, even if they're wrong.
Right.
But what I can tell you is that if you, when you go to the search cases tab at our site, what you're looking for is a geography and a victimology. Those are the things you set, where you're going to look and what kind of victim you're going to look at. When you set those and you see an alarming sea of red on the screen, red means unsolved, I think you should consider calling police.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, what you'll see is gray. Gray means the case was solved. You'll see that two-thirds of the time, because that's the rate at which we solve murder. But when you see the colors flip, and so that it's red is twice as much as gray on the screen, I really think you ought to consider having a conversation with your local police, because usually something's going on. It could be things like a very successful gang.
Right.
But frankly, probably the most common serial killer in America is the enforcer for local street gangs. And there are hundreds of them in this country. They do qualify as serial killers because they have killed lots. And they're usually the go-to guy when someone needs to be killed in a gang. And they usually don't get caught. So there's that. But also you'll have the sadosexual killers. Those will become obvious if you're looking at women victims. And I don't think I would discourage anyone from wanting to have a conversation if
right.
they're looking at a particular place and see way too many red cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the interesting thing, is like when you get down into the numbers, you know, you're not necessarily looking at the serial killer that we all might think. You know, we are looking at gangs, things like that, murder for hire, and, you know, and that doesn't mean it's not important, but I just think even I was learned a lot of things kind of looking at that site, you know.
Yeah. Also, frankly, this is something that web sleuths can do rather magnificently. When there is a pattern detected, you demonstrated that web sleuths are very good at being able to get down into the information of the particular cases. So
yeah,
we don't have the names of the victims. We just know that a 33-year-old black woman was strangled in Chicago in June of 2014. And so web sleuths are able to use their information systems and find out who that was and often get a narrative. Frankly, I think there could be a serial killer or killers working Chicago, because there are far too many unsolved strangulations of women. And so that would be something for web sleuths to take a look at. I mean, you can almost – there are uncaught serial killers in almost every major metropolitan area. There just are.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Accept that as a given. And
right.
usually you can find them. You can find many of them anyway. They become visually obvious. That's what we were trying to do with this project, is to crowdsource murder. And sometimes it works very effectively.
I have a question. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Josh. I have a question that has been asked all day today, Tom, and so hopefully you'll be able to answer it. VICAP needs data entry desperately just to enter the names of the victims. So many people want to volunteer. Why can't a volunteer help VICAP data entry, put those names in? What's stopping that from happening?
Well, the problem is we need data entry at the 22,000 police agencies. Nothing is coming into Quantico, Virginia. And so you have to go to the source, and you have to go to the homicide mm-hmm. detectives and ask, I'm willing to key this information in if you'll let me. But now you're back to the politics of the thing. Most police departments are not reporting to VICAP. And so is a citizen volunteer going to be able to change that that dynamic? I don't know. It's not simple. It's also not a simple thing to feed VICAP. You have to answer very specific questions that require not a small amount of knowledge about law enforcement. Also, you have to develop a narrative that explains the murder. It's the sort of thing that really is best done by the case investigator.
Okay.
I don't know, though. Personally, I think it's better than nothing to have interns at local police departments take a shot at it. And that's something I often tell detectives, don't you guys get interns? Maybe you don't know how to use the new online systems, but they do. And so why don't you let them try to do some of these things? We encourage them to let interns test theories at our website. Because, a 50-year-old homicide detective who has been down in the trenches his whole life is not very good clicking a mouse. You know, that's not what he does. Mm-hmm. But a 17-year-old intern who dreams of a career in law enforcement and is all gung-ho to do whatever he or she can do, that's just the guy you want or the girl you want to help out with the records part of law enforcement. And with some training, they would be able to do the 60-minute or so process of reporting a case to VICAP.
Wow.
But it's not a simple problem. And it's not a case – I mean, the FBI doesn't need interns at Quantico. They need interns everywhere else, people who are willing
right.
to help local law enforcement feed the data beast. And it's not a simple problem.
Well,
all right.
Also, Tom – one thing about your website and your organization, people can go to murderdata.org, is you do need help, and it's okay. You're a 501(c) charity, meaning if somebody makes
mm-hmm.
a donation, they can take it off on their taxes. So any size donation
yeah.
is greatly appreciated, right?
We are broke. We are just absolutely broke. And so what we will do with donations, and we've gotten $110 now, just in the last 2 days, and so we're very excited by that. What we're going to do, we're just now starting to take donations. We've been a 501(c)(3) since our very beginning, but we just have created the mechanics of being able to receive donations. And what we will do with the donations we get are basically of two types. First, when necessary, we'll use it to pay for lawyers to acquire data.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, we'll use it so that members of our board can go around the country and meet with homicide detectives and give demonstrations on how they can use our database very advantageously, how they can test theories for homicides. I've now appeared before five homicide groups, and it's like watching light bulbs turn on. They all get it. And every time I make an appearance, our traffic goes up, and it's cops using it. But the problem is there are just most there are hundreds of police organizations that have no money. And if we could go to them, we would go to as many as we have the funds to do to give these training programs so that they could see how online data can be useful. So that's what we would do with the money. Nobody gets paid. I don't get paid a penny. No one on our board. In fact, when we first organized, one of the promises I made to our board was we're going to put the non back into nonprofit, and we've kept that. Whatever money we get goes to training and goes to the cost of gathering data.
Well, as of tonight, you've got $210, so I'm in.
Oh,
I'm in for
more. Oh, wow.
Wow. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
I'll write you a letter.
There you go. Well, I just have to say, and if I can be kind of frank, and, you know, we've met a lot of people during this show, and we've met a lot of, like, you know, people helping, and literally for everybody out there who's listening, what Tom is doing is unbelievable. And it's really changing things on a national level. And so I'm happy to donate $100, but more than anything, Tom, what you're doing, we are all in awe of it, you know, and everybody who looks, watches this show is just completely in awe. So thank you from all of us to what you are doing.
You are very welcome, and thank you for the killing season. Frankly, if we had a few more roving groups of documentarians, we might make a dent in the unsolved murder mountain. what you guys have done is really, it's first very entertaining, but also it's very good, and you're resonating with all of the right themes. Most people don't realize the problems we have with homicide investigations and the problems we have with unsolved sex worker homicides. So what you've done is wonderful, and we're very grateful for the exposure you've given to us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. That's murderdata.org. You can go there and check out that incredible website. Maybe if everybody that visited Web Sleuth today donated $1, I'm telling you, murderdata.org would be set for a long, long time. Tom, thanks again. We'll have you on again real soon, I promise, okay?
Thanks so much. Bye, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Looking forward to seeing you in episode 8.
Okay, Josh, Rachel, Josh. We have one show left. We have two episodes coming up on Saturday. Give us a little peek, if you will.
So as we left it in episode 6, we venture west, and we look into probably the biggest serial murder case in the entire series. At least it is almost as big as Long Island, if not bigger. So that'll cover the entirety of episode 7, essentially. And then again, as Josh kind of alluded to, we'll be kind of going full circle and circling back to Long Island for some very interesting developments. And then Tom will make another guest appearance. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what people think about these next couple of episodes that will bring this season to a close.
And just in case listeners are knowing, we've been getting a lot of clues, a lot. And so we're investigating a lot of clues, and please keep them coming. You know, we don't know what's going to happen, if there is going to be a season 2, but I can tell you right now, if there is, we would have a lot to talk about. Trish, are we, you know, maybe we're going to do a show next week, correct?
We are. We have one more radio show left, podcast show, and it'll be a week
from
tonight, same time, 8 o'clock. So, yeah, we'll wrap up 7 and 8, and hopefully, keeping our fingers crossed, this will just keep going on a regular basis. So,
great. Well, we can be more excited.
Everybody think positive thoughts. So, okay, Saturday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, A&E, the final two episodes of The Killing Season. Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills, you guys are my heroes. Thank you for all you do. And we'll talk to you again
Thank
next
you.
Week, okay?
Take care now.
Take care.
Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bessie, our production, our producer, Bessie, does all the heavy lifting, all the hard work. Well, we just chat. So thank you, Bessie. And everybody, We'll be back next week, same time, same place, 8 o'clock Eastern, Web Sleuth Radio on Blog Talk. Talk to you then. Bye-bye.